Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. Selah. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. Though Martin Luther may have helped make this particular psalm more well-known, more famous, this psalm had been providing comfort and encouragement and strength well before the days of Luther. This psalm didn't just appear. It had a human author. And this human author wrote this particular psalm in response to events that happened in his life. Now, we're not told, like some psalms. At the beginning, we have these little descriptions underneath the title of the psalm that tell us why a particular psalm was written. We're not told why this particular psalm was written. So I'm not convinced we should be overly adamant about the occasion which merited the writing of the psalm. However, most commentators agree that the event that this psalm was written about reflects the drama that occurred between Hezekiah and Sennacherib, recorded in both 2 Kings 18 and 19 and 2 Chronicles 32. And as we make our way through this particular psalm this morning, we're going to use that historical event as a backdrop to help us understand this psalm. Now, I want to make sure that we understand that even if the events in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles were not what inspired the writing of this particular psalm, it won't affect our understanding of what we're talking about today. By using the historical events in 2 Kings 18 and 19 and 2 Chronicles 32, I want you and I to be reminded that this psalm is, if nothing else, should be applied to the events of our life. As hopefully we'll see, they were applied or could be applied in what transpired between Hezekiah and Sennacherib. In 722 BC, the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians. Sennacherib, the leader of the most powerful nation of his day, the Assyrians, then decides to attack the fortified cities of Judah, and he captures them. Hezekiah, as a result of that, agrees to pay tribute to Sennacherib, and in order to make his payment, Hezekiah takes the silver from his own house and from God's house and even some of the gold, and he gave it to Sennacherib. This activity or action seems to appease Sennacherib for a while. Then it appears that Sennacherib changed his mind. And Sennacherib sends a message to King Hezekiah demanding that Hezekiah surrender to not just the messenger that he sent, but as Scripture records in 2 Chronicles 32, the horde that he sent. Assyria has now marched on Jerusalem with their full force and their full army. Let's turn to 2 Kings and read just a little bit of how the end of this event plays out. So they've come, they've made the demands on Hezekiah. Then in 2 Kings 19, verse 14, this is how Hezekiah responds. 2 Kings 19, 14. Hezekiah received the letter from the hands of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God. You alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore, they were destroyed. So now, O Lord, our God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone. Hezekiah prays this, and then God graciously sends Isaiah with a message to Hezekiah. We're not going to read all of that, but we'll pick up the end of that in verse 29. Isaiah is finishing his message to Hezekiah, and he says, and this shall be the sign for you. This year, eat what grows of itself, and in the second year, what springs of the same. Then in the third year, sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat their fruit. And the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go out a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord will do this. Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city or shoot an arrow there or come before it with a shield or cast up a siege mound against it. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it, for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. And that night the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the people arose in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Now with this historical event in our minds, I want to work through the psalm, given the divisions that seem to be there by the writer. There are three selahs in there after verse 3, after verse 7, and then at the end. So the first part I want to consider is confidence, unshakable faith in a shakable world. Second, protection, an immovable city of an inhabited people. And third, deliverance, unbelievable works by an exalted God. So confidence, protection, and deliverance. So first, confidence. What we see is this unshakable faith. In verse 1, we read, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The psalmist is describing God as a shelter, some place that they can find trust and safety. What the psalmist is saying is, since it's God in which I put my trust, and since it's God who is unchangeable in his power, authority, and rule in this world in which I am trusting, it doesn't matter what happens. Because no matter what happens, it can't affect his stability and it can't affect his authority in the world. See, what we see in this verse is that sometimes God is a refuge. And he'll shield us from what's going on around us. But other times, he's a strength. In the midst of our affliction, in the midst of our suffering, he upholds and he strengthens. See, Psalm 46 is not saying that we are not going to endure hard times. In essence, Psalm 46 is saying we are going to endure hard times. And there will be times when God will shelter us from those things that assail us. And there are some times that God will strengthen us in the midst of those things that come into our world. He's a refuge. He's a strength. But what the Hebrew behind this suggests is that whether he's a refuge or a strength, God is an exceeding or a superlative help in difficulties. We use the word very present help in trouble. I was a high school teacher for 15 years, and I absolutely hated the word very. I thought it was a weak word. Something's hot. Something's very hot. English lacks in this category. We really want to say something in a strong way, and what do we use? We put the word very there. It's not very good. But the sense here is that this God that is a refuge and strength, that he is a help beyond imagination, beyond anything that you can think about. This is the best help that you can find. The Hebrew writer is trying to express this in the strongest of terms so that the reader knows that no matter what, there is a God that can help. And then he paints a picture of why this superlative help is merited. Because it's not in a creature, it's in God himself. And though there might be things that challenge this, which we read in verse 2, therefore we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. See, what the writer does is he takes the most fixed objects in the world. He takes the mountain. And he says, even though the mountains be moved. Or he takes the sea. We have a privilege of living just by Lake Michigan. And we have gone there on some fairly windy days. And you see the waves come crashing in. And you really do feel the lake roar. But that pales, I think, to what the psalmist is saying here. He's saying, though you go and hear the great seas, the great oceans, and the waves are coming and crashing again and again and again, almost thundering against the shore, though that happens, it doesn't matter. There's no reason to fear. Why? Because God is a refuge and strength. John Calvin puts it this way. It's an easy matter to manifest the appearance of great confidence as long as we are not placed in imminent danger. But if in the midst of a general crash of the whole world and our minds continue undisturbed and free of trouble, this is evidence that we attribute to the power of God the honor which belongs to him. You see, it's easy to trust in God. It's easy to say that we trust in God when things are going well. But he says, it's real trust when your world is crashing around you, when mountains are being moved, when the sea is roaring, and when then you can still trust in God. That's faith. Think about Hezekiah. We read that 185,000 men had come up against Jerusalem.
Do you think the ground was shaking as 185 men stormed towards Jerusalem? This is an ivory tower theology. There was a time when 185,000 men stood around the city of Jerusalem and the ground was shaking underneath the weight of the war machine that approached. We don't know if Psalm 46 was written about that, but we do know what Hezekiah said about it. In 2 Chronicles 32, he says, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or dismayed before the king of Assyria and the horde that is with him. For there are more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help and fight our battles." God is a refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Are there those here that know anything of what verses 1 through 3 are saying? I don't think you have to live very long before your world is shaken. When mountains get moved and seas roar, and you feel this type of turmoil. We live in a world that's full of sin. And that sin creates devastation in all of our lives. And we feel it. And sometimes our world becomes a hard world. And maybe some of the most solid things in your world, your mountains, have been uprooted. And you look at circumstances of your life and you say, I don't know what to do with this. What does God want me to do with this? Maybe you've undergone some struggles in your life and your sea is roaring. Maybe nobody else sees it. Maybe nobody even knows it. That you have the ability to give the impression that you're a calm sea, but the sea within is roaring. And maybe you can't bring yourself to say what the psalmist says this morning. That you haven't been able to say with confidence that God is my refuge and strength and therefore I won't fear. So what gives the psalmist this ability? What allowed him to have such confidence in God? Move into point numbers 2 and 3 and see. Point 2 is protection, an immovable city. These verses 4 through 7, give us God's defense of the holy city of God. In the immediate context, if we do take the opinion that this is during the time of Hezekiah and Sennacherib, this would refer to Jerusalem. In verse 4, we read, there's a river, and there is a river that does flow into Jerusalem. So I think we can assume that this is at least Jerusalem. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. This has been interpreted in a lot of different ways. Some say they're the literal small streams that water Jerusalem. Some say that it's the scriptures themselves, God's word, and his commandments, his law, his ordinances. Some have said that it's the grace and the consolations of the Holy Spirit. Others have said that it's the overflowing stream of God's mercy which gladdens the saints. Now, I would suggest that it refers both to the literal streams of Jerusalem that brought the people the much-needed water that they lived off of. But I'd also suggest that it would be the streams of the Lord that watered his people. Throughout the scriptures, God constantly referred to himself as the water of life, streams of life, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. So I think there's a literal sense that it is actual streams, but I think there's a spiritual sense that it refers to God supplying his people. One commentator, Plummer, has written, "The resources of God's people are found in the perpetual stream of blessing which flow from God's wisdom and mercy through Jesus Christ." And as verse 5 said, that those blessings specifically are the protection that comes through God's presence with his people. Verse 5 says, "God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns." Calvin writes, "If we desire to be protected by the hand of God, we must be concerned above all things that he may dwell with among us. For all hope of safety depends on his presence alone." Isn't that what we read from Hezekiah from 2 Chronicles 32? Don't be scared of the horde that's outside. Why? Because there's more with us than with them. And more with us doesn't mean numbers necessarily. It could just be one. God is with us. And if God is with us, it doesn't matter how many are outside of the city. God is in the city. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. Then we see in verse 6 that God looks at whatever the situation and circumstances of the psalmist and says, in essence, stop. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice. The earth melts. You can't get much more dense writing than what you find in verse 6. This is 8 words. In Hebrew, you can't write any more concisely than this. This is a verb-noun sequence. So it goes verb-noun, 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 verb-noun. And this, even in our English, it's fairly compact. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter, he utters his voice, the earth melts. There's an intensity here. Nations rage, kingdoms totter, gives voice, earth melts. It's about power. See, all this is going on. Nations are raging around. Think of Sennacherib and his mighty horde. Can you imagine the noise that 185,000 men make on the verge of a battle that they think is a done deal? And in the midst of that, God speaks. And the earth melts. So much expressed by so little. God is there. But God's not only in the midst of Jerusalem protecting her from Sennacherib. He's in the midst of his church protecting her and making sure that she's not moved throughout all ages. See, this is where Luther understood that this was not just about the time and place that it was written, that it was about all times. Think of Luther's world. His world was in upheaval. The church was in ruins, and Luther's world is raging even inside of himself. And he's called to defend himself at Worms, and his friends are saying, "Don't go to Worms to defend yourself." And Luther says, even though there might be more demons on the road to Worms as tiles on the roof, I need to go. And you know what he said? Because God is with me. When Luther would struggle in life and would feel the pressures of the, just the weight of what he was struggling against coming down upon him, he would turn to his right-hand man, Melanchthon, and said, let's sing the 46th. Let's sing Psalm 46. See, no matter what rises against the city of God, Sennacherib, the rulers of at the Diet of Worms, the threats to the church of today, God defends his people. And he's saying, don't fear no matter what happens. Then look at verse 7. Verse 7 reveals two aspects of God's character. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Saying he's the Lord Almighty, the Lord of hosts. Yahweh, Jehovah Sabaoth is how it comes out in the mighty fortress is our God. That's what, probably you're saying this as children and saying, what is Jehovah Sabaoth? Just means the Lord Almighty, the Lord of hosts. This is the same idea from 2 Kings 6 when they're looking out and they're surrounded and Elisha turns to his servant and says, don't worry. There's more with us than with them. He prays that God might open up the eyes of his servant that he might see the host of heaven defending his people. This is in essence what Hezekiah does, isn't it? There's a horde out there, but there's more with us. Who are the more? The more is the Lord of hosts. But he's also the God of Jacob, the God of a covenant. God is not only the God of hosts, he is the covenant-keeping God of Jacob. It's interesting that he chose to use the word Jacob here. There's other patriarchs that maybe would have been better choices. And he didn't even use Jacob's changed name. He used the supplanter. Saying it doesn't depend on that side of the covenant. It depends on my side of the covenant. I am the covenant-keeping, faithful God, even though you might be a bunch of Jacobs. I'm not. I am the Lord Almighty. I have immeasurable power and I also am faithful. And I remember my own. I will take care of my children. I am a God, a fatherly God of love that cannot forsake his Jacob. One commentator wrote, the God of Jacob is the Lord of hosts, but more wondrous still, the Lord of hosts is the God of Jacob. Before we leave point number two, we need to be reminded that God's presence among his people will not exempt them from problems, but it will guarantee that those problems will not be for their destruction. God might not keep the bush from burning, but he will keep the bush from being consumed. Point three is deliverance. Unbelievable works by an exalted God. Verse 8, that we are told to come and behold the works of the Lord. In the busyness of our life, in the chaos of our life, I think it's easy to forget to come behold the works of the Lord. I think sometimes we forget that God is still working and moving within his people and within his church today. And he wants us to stop and see it. He wants us to, hopefully you took time in this last week not only to to say what you're thankful for, but to be reminded of the faithfulness of God in the previous year. What has God done? Come and see. Verse 9, he makes war cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Remember what we read prior from 2 Kings 19? That not one arrow was going to come into the city. No shield, no battering rams. He makes war cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Pretty sure that nobody here probably has a Sennacherib outside your door. Probably none of you have 185,000 men seeking your destruction. Or do we? Actually, I'm not convinced that our enemies might not be greater. See, each of us have to be delivered from sin and Satan in ourselves. And ultimately, we all have to be delivered from the final judgment. And just like Hezekiah, we're up against enemies that we cannot defeat. Hezekiah looked out and he said that these people are stronger than I am, but they're not stronger than God. And we are in similar situations. We look against enemies, sin and Satan and ourselves, and we look at them and we say they are stronger than we are. But they're not stronger than God. The psalmist knew this. Look at the phrases from 8 and 9. Behold the works of the Lord. He has brought desolation. He makes wars cease. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. It's God working. It's God acting. It's God delivering. He's the one that's conquering. See, the psalmist, Hezekiah, knew that they needed to take refuge in God alone. Have you found that you need to take refuge in God alone to deliver you from your own sinful heart? If you're indwelt by the Lord of hosts and you're a child of God, you'll find that the deliverance of God is total. That no arrow of the enemy can ultimately harm us. I think this is what Paul was talking about at the end of Romans 8. What can separate us from the love of God? And he uses his imagination to try to think of any possible thing that could separate him from the love of God. And he says, there's nothing that can do it. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is talking about death. And he says, the death is swallowed up by victory. Death, where is your sting? Not one arrow will come into the city. But notice the response to this great deliverance. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. Probably one of the most misquoted verses in the Bible. I think most of the time, maybe I just have been around most people that misquote this verse. The be still, this contemplative state. Oh, just be still. Relax. This is really means to cease, to forbear, to stop, to let alone. It's the idea that you're supposed to just shut your mouth. Like if I was upset with my students in my classroom when I used to teach and they were saying things or carrying on beyond what they should have, and I was not very happy, and they just needed to be still. shut your mouth. That's the sense here. That's the strength. It's not this nice little contemplative verse. This is a verse of power. Stop. Be still. It's like when you're frustrated with your little children and you're carrying on a little bit too much, and finally you just say, be still. That's verse 10. And then what it's saying is, be still and stand in awe of God. Know He's God. Stop all your activity and just behold God. And in that silence, there should arise this sense of reverence and awe and wonder at the magnitude of God. In essence, what the psalmist is saying at the end is, be quiet and worship. Trust Him with all of your circumstances, with all of your lives and your fear. The psalm, I believe, so beautifully communicates our need to place our confidence in God and reveals Him as our fortress in which we're to find protection. But it's fascinating to me that verse 11 repeats verse 7. What's the psalmist doing? The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. I think what the psalmist is doing here is using this literary device of repetition to say, this is the best part. Don't miss it. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Maybe a story would help. John Wesley, on his deathbed, nearly lost his voice, could only be heard with extreme difficulty. And at the last, with all the strength that he could summon, he said, the best of all is God is with us. Then raising his hand slightly and waving it in triumph, he exclaimed again, the best of all is God is with us. Each of us need to find that same truth and reality in our own lives. That come what may, the best of all is God is with us. May we put our trust in this God that is a refuge and strength and ever-present help in time of need.